Welcome to Fit and Chips Chats. This is a podcast for women over 40 who are looking for sane and frank advice about their health and wellness, especially through menopause. I'm Amanda Thebe, the original resilient bitch and menopause guru. In my work as a personal trainer and nutrition coach, and through my own personal experience, it became obvious to me information about menopause and this curious phase of our life was so ridiculously hard to find. And that's why I started this podcast. Join me every week as I speak to health and wellness experts on hot topics that directly impact you. I've made it my mission to help you by exploding a few myths, presenting you with the facts, and hoping to inspire you to be a healthy, strong person just like me. If you like this show, please subscribe and leave a review. Then go and tell your friends, and then go and tell your husband, and then tell the neighbor, and then don't forget to visit me at fitandchips.com. And now let's get started on today's show. Welcome back to this week's episode of Fit and Chips Chats. I have Dr. Susan Kleiner on the show with me today. She is the owner of High Performance Nutrition, which is a consulting firm in Mercer Island, Washington. I'm saying that like I have any idea where that is. My US geography is still terrible. She's the director of science and communication for Vitargo. Is that how you pronounce it, Vitargo?
Yes, Vitargo Inc.
And one of the main reasons I asked Susan on the show is because she's an author of 8 books. Her new book is called The New Power Eating. But I met Susan at the Girls Gone Strong conference, 4 years ago now. And Susan's was my absolute favorite presentation, bar none. And one of the reasons is Susan deals with, she works with a lot of athletes, many, many professional teams. But she also really, truly promotes just great health and wellness for women, especially we were talking about the carbohydrate sort of like conundrum as well, that, you know, women are sort of scared of eating their carbohydrates. And Susan has all of this amazing knowledge that she just delivers to us in a way that just makes it just makes sense. And you were just saying to me, I'd love to know this story, Susan. You were just saying to me that this book, The Power Eating, that you wrote this book primarily initially for athletes because you deal with athletes, but it's reaching this broader audience, which is fantastic. And you've had people who are morbidly obese buying the book, and it's really helping them. Can you just tell me a little bit more about, you know, how that started?
Yeah. First of all, Amanda, thank you so much for having me here. It's really fun to participate in these chats, and I listen to yours all the time, and I am also a fan. So thank you for the work.
Oh, no way. Come on. Thank you. Thank you.
So, you know, the latest book is really kind of the 5th edition of Power Eating, but we have renamed it, freshened it up with a very creative new title called The New Power Eating. And so that's the new book. But the story really begins with the first edition of Power Eating, which was published in maybe 1997. And I had waited a decade to put together a book until there was truly a body of scientific evidence to talk about diet for strength and power. And that was my original research with competitive bodybuilding men, and then moving on to both competitive bodybuilding men and women, the first to ever do substantial research in nutrition and diet and outcomes. Anyway, when there was significant data, we wrote Power Eating, and it was really meant for the athletically inclined individual, the person who challenges themselves athletically. And it was all about getting into the weight room and starting to lift. And this was still in the days where there were lots of those bad old weight training rooms that were pretty stinky. They were mostly all free weights. It was mostly a lot of men grunting and a few women, of which I was one. I had this wonderful young woman who was a professional bodybuilder. She had her pro card train me, and that was just inspirational at the time. I never got on stage. It was never my goal. I wanted to get stronger. And so the copy editor on Power Eating was someone I never met. You work long distance together. You're sending things back and forth. And at the end of the book, when it was ready to launch, she called me and she said, "Dr. Kleiner, you've never seen me, but I need to tell you my story. I am not a target of your audience, but for the first time in reading your book, I understood that I didn't need to be in spandex to exercise in a room full of women jiggling up and down and running around and doing aerobic training, that being in the strength room was a place that I could train, get healthy, and maybe that could also help me lose weight." She was over 300 pounds. I had no idea. And this was a, you know, an average size woman. I can't tell you her height right now, but probably around 5'5", 5'6". Mm-hmm. And she said, "I never went to the gym because I didn't think I could go in my sweats, but I could go into the weight room in sweats." And she had worked on the book for 6 months, and over those 6 months, she had lost about 80 pounds.
Oh, come on. That's amazing. Yeah. What a great story.
It was a jaw dropper, and I was in tears, and the book wasn't even published yet.
This is in 1998.
It was probably in 98, yes. Something like that. I actually, honestly, well, here I can think I can see. I don't know if it'll tell me on the front of this book when the first one was published, but it was about that time. And so, 98. So it was probably the end of 97, because I think it came out around January of 1998. So it was just a jaw dropper, and it widened my sort of mental view of who could potentially be my reader. And so I went into a little more depth in the next books. I certainly broadened out as much as I could to include women. I always included women. It wasn't meant to be an exclusively male book, but there was no research except my own on women at that time. But then every 5 years, as I've published a new book, a minimum of 5 years or maximum of 5 years between books, it has enlarged my focus continuously as we have more and more data. So it's not a diet book. It's a book about eating more to increase your energy so that you can train harder, build muscle, and if you need to lose fat, you will. That is the power eating paradigm. And it is based on the concept of abundance and the abundant ability of our bodies to respond when we respect the need for nourishment and energy. And so I always take the view of the athlete that wants to accomplish goals. And I have, you know, I narrow everything down to three words: fuel your goals. Even if your goal is partially weight loss, a goal in my mind is more short term, something that you can actually accomplish and feel and see. Weight loss is an outcome of accomplishing those goals. And so having things like winning a race, lifting heavier weight, running faster, getting your cholesterol levels down, improving your carbohydrate metabolism, making your skin look better, sleeping better, all of those things are goals. Drinking more water every day, eating a plant-rich diet, you know, those kinds of things on a daily basis, we can pat ourselves on the back and check off. And then once you sort of straighten all those things out, get yourself aligned and stick to it over time. And that feeling of daily success helps you stick to it and change old habits into new ones.
Carry on. All I was going to say is the one thing that stands out from that is when you talk about this abundance, and it's just such a great way to word it, like to, you know, respect the need to nourish our body, like actually just to respect our body instead of punishing our body over with food, which is just seems to be the way that the diet industry has gone. It's all about restriction, and it's so upsetting to see. And I know that this is your jam, and so, like, not jam, but I know this is your jam. And so yes. I love that, because you want people to really enjoy food and to nourish their bodies so that they do have that mental clarity, that better mood, you know, get a body that really works for them. I know that that's what you're trying to sort of show people. what does that look like? Like, what does that look like for women like me or women like you who are sort of like midlife onwards? Because we know we've got challenges. What have you sort of noticed for yourself even?
So one of the things that is clear to me in the women, so I am older than 60, and I have actually reframed my, well, age has always been kind of meaningless to me, and I'm fortunate because I had older parents who were very sharp mentally and physically their entire lives and were very physically active just in their everyday work. Yeah. They had physical jobs, and so they stayed very healthy. And I, you know, have to admit that my genes, you know, probably are at least 50% of all of this as well. However, I have reframed my focus on age, and instead of people saying, "Oh, you're in the last third," well, forget it. I'm in the second half, as far as I'm concerned. I'm in my third quarter. I got lots of time to accomplish a lot of things, because I think of everything in sort of a sports reference. And so to me, yes, I've definitely lived through the first half, but with how long we live when we take care of ourselves today, I'm only in the third quarter, which means I got a lot of taking care of myself to do.
And a lot of living left to do,
and
right?
A lot of living left to do. And this is actually the time of life when you really get freed up a little more to do those things. And so the women that I know, both my clients as well as my friends and circle of friends, is one thing we all did as we started to approach sort of perimenopause was we ramped it up and we started working out harder, and we added a sport we had never done before. We really started to change it up and do different things. For me, I had never been a runner. I never liked running. I'd run, you know, when I had to, 3 miles or, I'd do 5Ks, but never distance running. And I thought, okay, my daughter's starting to do half marathons. I'm just going to do that. And it just sort of, it wrapped around perimenopause for me. And we picked fun things, like we did the Run Disney in Disneyland. We did a half marathon. And then
I have a few people that have done that. I think I have to do it, because like 3 runs you can do in a weekend as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is so much fun. Nobody's coming to race. Everyone's going to finish. Everyone's in costumes. We did the Tinkerbell half marathon. Then I did the Disney Run, Wine, and Dine on the East Coast, so I could get, 3 medals instead of just 2, because I did a coast to coast in 1 year. Anyways, we made it about as fun as we could. I did the East Coast one with a colleague, and we had a ball. So here's the thing. I think, when I look at the females in, sort of a generation or two older than me, everyone went through menopause in a very difficult way. I kind of breezed through. I can't say that it's because I started to do something very intensive and new very regularly, because I was on a pretty serious training schedule. But all I know is that my symptoms were low. And what I hear from women who have done the same thing, it doesn't have to be, it could be that they started lifting and they always ran, it could be anything new. But even in your favorite thing that you've always done, ramp it up, make things harder. Everyone reports the same thing. And now that data is starting to trickle out a little bit. So I think that it's both not just getting through that more difficult sort of, for some people, a decade long period of time, for others, maybe a shorter period of time. But I think not only does it improve how we feel on a day-to-day basis, but I think it improves long-term, because our hormonal status seems to be, and this is the data coming out, seems to stay more steady. We don't go into these huge, very sudden dips.
we see that with like obesity, especially, women have a much more challenging time. And the episode that's just gone live today is with Dr. Roseanne Woods, and she got her PhD based purely on this, about symptomatic, the symptomatic side of menopause based on lean body mass. Mm-hmm. You know, and it really does seem to show like a massive reduction. And so, but being active, even just for your mental health, or even over the physical symptoms, I think is really key. Right. And I remember we had a conversation before where, and I often quote it because it just really resonated with me. It's that midlife often sort of shows up as a time when women start to doubt their athletic performance or abilities, right? And we get nervous, scared, and for sure that's linked with the hormonal fluctuations and just our confidence at the time. So I mean, maybe that's why it helped you just ramping it up, just to challenge yourself a little bit more in that respect.
Right. Yeah, I mean, pick something that you never thought you could do. Now, on the other hand, we can be slightly more at risk, right? Our connective tissues are not as resilient as our estrogen levels start to drop. And so you do want to be cognizant of that. And so if you've never ever skied before, you can certainly learn to ski, but don't start out trying to do black diamonds right away, because you might not just fall and bump and hurt yourself. You might tear an ACL. You might, you know, tear something at this point in life that maybe you would have been a little more resilient with otherwise. The same with running. In fact, we have to be careful about plantar fasciitis. All of those issues around connective tissue, make sure that when you begin, you learn how to do it well. Get a good coach who knows how to work with women in your stage of life. And that is absolutely critical. A good trainer, a good guide, a good coach, good equipment. Yeah. Make sure, you know, all the things to make sure that you are that you have positioned yourself for success. But 100%, women become afraid and they slow down and they pull back and they do less, not more. And doing less becomes that much more difficult. And then if they are overweight, certainly, you know, fat is not benign. It is the largest endocrine tissue in our body. Yes. And it's pumping out everything to increase inflammation. And so that just alters our reproductive system massively. And so, yes, I totally agree with those comments.
Hi, guys. Amanda here. I'm just jumping in to ask you a quick favor. If you are enjoying my podcast, then I'd love you to leave me a review on either iTunes or Google Play. It helps me get in front of new listeners so I can keep making great content for you. And in return, I'd like to send you my Abs on Fire 12-week core-focused workout plan. All you need to do after you've done your review is simply email me at amanda@fitandchips.com and I'll send you the program straight away. Thanks, guys, for all your support. And now back to the show. And so one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, sort of leading on to that, as well as our health and everything, is just like the food that we eat that helps us. Like, and so I've got to the stage now where I think women shouldn't just, we used to just diet for, you know, maybe vanity, maybe just fitness. But it's really, for me, women should be fueling for health as well. Like, and I think that this becomes more clear to us when we do have these challenging times thrown upon us. I mean, I know that that's where I am in life. Like, I feel like keeping a good low lean body mass is really, a high lean body mass and a low body fat percentage, mm-hmm. Has really helped me make this whole sort of time of my life a lot more bearable. I'm not as symptomatic as some people are, but I do know that like the food I eat now, it's not really based on like the number on the scale or anything. It's like how I feel. And so this is what I wanted to talk to you about as far as like carbohydrate story, because I love what you have to say about this. And women are scared of carbohydrates, and there's people out there telling them not to eat them anymore and only to eat high fats and high proteins, which, well, obviously we need the proteins. And it's so confusing. So confusing when people are saying in menopause, you've got to eat keto. And I'm like, why are we being told this?
So, you know, it is, first of all driven by Madison Avenue. Just to begin with, there is no data to support everyone going on a ketogenic diet. Zero data. It is a massive illusion that has overtaken the United States. And only in the United States, where food is so abundant, could people get so carried away with high restriction. So just to know, this is a serious first world problem.
Yeah.
Then the ketogenic diet was designed to treat epilepsy. It goes all the way back to Hippocrates and Greek times. I mean, let's, you know, be clear that it was evidence-based, you know, somewhat, and today still is used in some children's hospitals as an option when medications are not working very well or as an adjunct to prescription therapy. However, the data on the ketogenic diet and sort of health parameters is very short-term data. And what we're starting to see with people who are following very high-fat, low-carb diets are a whole host of problems. So just to begin with, the biggest thing that women are concerned about typically as we get older is our gut function.
Right.
And bloating and discomfort and all of that. Well, if you don't have fiber in your diet, and I'm saying a variety of fibers in your diet, including fiber from grain, you cannot feed the bacterial cultures in your gut in an abundant way so that you keep your gut healthy and you keep inflammatory responses low. And so what happens in a ketogenic diet is the bacterial, so your gut biome changes and you have a high level of pathogenic bacteria and a low level of our helpful, healthful bacteria. And there's all kinds of gut risk and gut inflammation that has been shown over time. There's problems in children who have been on the ketogenic diet who are epileptic with bone mineral metabolism. That's the number one thing that is being investigated right now. So we came into this world as omnivores. And that means we need animal foods in our diet. We can supplement if we're vegan, and people can do it healthfully if they are conscious and they do it well and they're well educated on how to do a vegan diet, but you must supplement numbers of different things. And on the flip side, we also must eat a robust plant-based diet. And that doesn't mean, you know, one stalk of celery every day. That really means, you know, a wide variety of fruits and vegetables, grains and beans, and nuts and seeds. And so if you are, and there's a whole new book out about this where she talks about cultured foods, but really the focus of the book is what we call prebiotics, not the probiotic, but the fiber required to feed the biome. And looking at the original research that we started to study Native African populations that had very healthy guts, the original research was looking at fiber, and Dr. Burkett was running around weighing poop and looking at you know, figuring out how much fiber. And he said, well, fiber was very important because it kind of scrubbed the gut and it helped clean out the gut and it helped carry out excess cholesterol and bile and all of these things. Well, fiber is critically important, but what we actually think is those things that he talked about are a side note, that the primary job of fiber in the diet is feeding the gut biome. And where we recommend USDA 25 to 30 grams a day, a ketogenic individual may have 5 grams a day, maybe 10, that these healthy tribes in Africa are eating 100 grams of fiber a day. So it starts to give you pause when we tell people don't eat carbohydrates, because you can't get fiber from fat or protein.
No. And, you know, it's interesting as well, because there's chances are that a lot of people aren't even getting the 25 to 30 grams in a regular diet. Right. Right? To me, one of the things I see missing a lot, that people don't take the opportunity to fill up on vegetables and fruit. They're so good for you in so many other ways as well. But like just the fact that they barely reach that 30 grams a day. And then there's the other camp that I often hear women say, well, I can only have 25 grams of fructose every day, so I'm not going to eat fruit anymore. And I'm like, these messages have just got so mixed up and convoluted along the way that now people are scared to eat fruit for their fiber.
Right. And all of that is, I'm telling you, it is mostly creative writing. The data that are out there, I have to be honest that there are several scientists that have financial incentives to be publishing the research that they're publishing, and they do not disclose it in their publications, which is, you know, astounding to those of us who are absolutely transparent with our financial relationships with corporations. And so be very careful about following things. If you can't get data that says, for someone like you, it doesn't matter if it works for someone who's got heart disease and that's not you. It doesn't matter. You know, that's not a woman trying to enhance her performance. Now, one thing that we do know that is relative to grains, and just to be, you know, sort of on both sides, there is so much nuance to all of this. And when we talk about grains, there are people that are responding negatively to grains. It may be somewhat gluten sensitivity. It may be other things that are added in the processing of commercial breads and flours and baked goods. And this is what I'm working with the Washington State University Bread Lab, doing amazing stuff. And I'm actually going to be presenting on heritage grains with the man who just built a new mill, flour mill, using stone grinding, ancient systems with brand new technology to make it commercially viable. We're going to be presenting at the ISSN annual conference in Las Vegas in June.
And, you know, that interests me because I'm obviously
so your experience.
European. Well, I'm British, but you know, we're still a part of Europe at the moment. And when I had to just add that in at the moment. But for example, like France, you don't see any sort of like real issues with gluten or any sort of like sensitivities, and you don't hear about celiac being thrown around either. And I think that they do process their breads very differently. Like the grains are completely processed differently. And I literally can't eat the bread over here. I struggle to eat the bread just because I think it's lesser quality. It's been over processed, and that has to have a huge part to play in the quality of food that we're eating.
Yeah. So I want, you know, sort of to help people expand their horizons, and it isn't easy. You know, back in the day when I was looking for healthy bread, we would get Ezekiel bread, which now, you know, which used to be very hard to find, and now you can get it, you know, sprouted grain bread in the frozen section of many, many grocery stores. But we, what our grain and bread supply, there's all kinds of complicated issues with, you know, all our grains that we're eating are not actually from the United States in the flour that we're eating. And there's issues with transport and how the grains have to be treated with pesticides before they are transported in containers. And there's just all kind, they treat the container with pesticides. And so, I mean, I have all this information that I had suspected, that I had heard, and now I know the facts. And there's a lot of nuance to learn. And so I will be presenting, I'll be starting to write on this, because I want people to understand how important grains are in the diet. And it's not all grains. And maybe some of us who care enough, you know, I grind my own flaxseed in the morning. Maybe it's not going to be very long that I start to grind my own flour, because, and lots, and people do this because I can access the grain. I'm fortunate enough to be able to access flour here because of this mill. These mills will start to be built around the country again. But the concept is not anti-carbohydrate. That is the most important thing. That there are things being done, even though we have a very safe food supply. In order to make it safe, on one hand, we have allowed things that are not so healthy that we had no data on until we have generations of people consuming this on the other hand, right? Yeah. So you know, it's kind of like I'm gonna jump back to our periods and say it's like the birth control pill, where we are, or any kind of hormonal birth control, where Dr. Elliot Sale is finding that, oh my, you know, all hormonal birth control may not be so good for us, and in more ways than one. And if you don't follow Krista Elliot Sale, you should. And there is some fascinating data that she is coming out with that was completely unexpected. I mean, she was looking at female athletic performance and is starting to find perhaps other very negative complications. And so,
I think that's the work that Stacey Sims is doing as well.
Yes, yes.
They're almost identical. You've just said what she said as well. So that's pretty interesting. But yes, so the... Wow, we were all over. I love this, though. There's so much to talk about. And the thing is, the great thing about it is that you've just got such a wide body of work, and that's what's so great. But I know that the crux of your work is really just to deliver these proven strategies that work for athletes and for, you know, athletic people or people who exercise, just to, you know, make things like make sense. Because I think we're living in such a crazy world at the moment that people are like, they believe something, then they talk to the friend, and then they literally have changed their mind because there's just so much BS out there.
Right.
Yeah. And so I that's why I love the work you do, because you do make it practical for people to follow, but it's all backed up. And if things change, then you tell us it changes, you know, because that's the, I bet you in the 10 years since you've written the first book, science has moved on incredibly.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's actually 20 years, so it's really moved on.
See, that was my menopause brain not being able to do the math.
but fundamentally, so the message is, and this started, I went to a women's conference here in Seattle probably 25 years ago, and it was frankly sickening. As I walked through the trade show, every woman was in there doing something that she would normally never do out in public, you know, having their hair colored, doing stuff to their skin, people they didn't know. And all, every message was that your body is broken and I can fix it. Just listen to me. I can fix it. Whether, you know, no matter what it is. And this concept, it's a total approach to life. It's a life philosophy. Do you see the world as a place of abundance or a place of scarcity? Do you see the glass as half empty or half full? I see my world as a place of abundance. I expect that. I certainly prepare for the worst, but I expect the best. And so I expect the best out of my body. And if I want it to perform at its best, whether it's when I'm talking to you on a podcast, or I'm being able to communicate in coherently with my husband at 9 o'clock at night, or I'm trying to train and lift and run and cycle and do everything else I want to do, then I need to give it the tools that it needs to do so. And I expect it to work properly. That it's that the only way that I will be able to do those things is to allow my body to operate in abundance, not in restriction. Because when you restrict, you can't buy a car for less money than the amount that they expect to pay you. You can't say, well, you know, I'm not going to pay $18,000 for that car. I'm going to pay you $12,000 and expect the same performance out of a car. You can't get the same car. Well, you can't get the same body either. You either have to fill it up and allow it to work at peak operation capacity, which is where it works its best. When we're only sort of kind of limping along, everything in the body slows down.
It's not what it wants. I agree. It wants to be challenged. It wants to drive, doesn't it? It doesn't want to just be sluggish.
Right.
And you must be doing something right, Susan, because they can't see you and I can. You just look amazing. When you said you were over 60, my jaw dropped. I was like, holy crap. I thought you were like a couple of years older than me. So, wow. So there's some aging goals for me. But this was great. We have to wrap it up now, but I really love what you have to say. Can people just find you at your website at drsplina.com?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll make sure that that's in the description of the podcast. You can also buy the new power cleaning, the woman's cleaning on the front. That's why I said it. The new power eating book. And, everything that Dr. Susan Kleiner has to say is so helpful. So I absolutely encourage you to go over. And I'd just like to say thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. We can do it again.
Great. We should. I'm hoping there's lots of questions from this one and I can get you back on and just answer some specifics. That would be great. But thank you again, Susan.
Thank you, Amanda. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to the show. For more information on my services, head over to my website at fitandchips.com. That's like fish and chips, fitandchips.com. Or you can head over to my Fit and Chips Facebook page too. If you leave me a comment or if you contact me, I promise I'll do my best to respond to all of your questions. The views and advice expressed by myself in this show are not a substitute for conventional medical service. No information here should be interpreted as a medical diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of any disease. If in any doubt, always go straight to your doctor. Take care. Love you. Bye.